Good evening, everyone. And so I'm curious to hear from you first about how it was to practice your meditation this last week and what your experiences were with paying attention to the five faculties and trying to strengthen them, enhance them, and maybe bring them into balance. What happened for you, some of you? Or any questions you might have had about them?
Today was the first day that I was really able to concentrate on the breath, very soon after I sat down. So, and then continued. There were distractions, but I kept coming back. So I felt very pleased, very proud, which I think is not the right feeling. Because the other times during the week, if I meditated in the evening, I kept falling asleep, or the distractions were so great. I found myself focusing on the counting of the breath rather than the breath. But today things seem to come together.
Great. Thank you.
I noticed my my energy and my faith that's much more strong. But when it came and my mindfulness, I never really looked at pleasant and unpleasant before. I know that we lacked in concentration.
You lacked in concentration?
Concentration, I know that was no problem. And wisdom, I can't get a hold of. Is wisdom, thinking, is that those thoughts? Or is
there, in relationship to the five faculties, I think of wisdom as being a power of discernment. And maybe discernment involves a little bit of thinking, but it involves being able to see connections and distinctions between things. So if it's as simple as being able to see the operation of the five faculties. It's the wisdom faculty which is able to discern whether energy is weak or concentration is weak or the faith is too much or discernment itself, which would notice, oh, there's not enough discernment here. So that's partly how it operates.
It didn't seem like that much of a multifaceted analysis of my experience to look at the five faculties, and maybe it's because I don't understand that well, but it seemed that if I meditated in the morning, I had lots of energy, and then I was very mindful and could concentrate easily. And I meditated in the evening, then I didn't have much energy, and then I wasn't very mindful and couldn't concentrate very well. I have the same amount of faith and apply about the same amount of wisdom all the time.
Good for you.
And similar to what this one said, I noticed it seemed like there's a very fine line between applying wisdom and engaging the thinking mind in an inappropriate way.
Sure, I grant you that. But did you try to experiment with strengthening energy, for example, when you're sleepy? Bringing more energy into the practice and thereby having more mindfulness or more concentration?
You said, for example...
So did you experiment with trying to enhance energy factor when you were tired?
I would try to apply more determination.
More determination.
Corral all the available energy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And was that successful?
Somewhat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's various ways, strategies for increasing the energy. And when we're tired, that's one of the classic times to try to bring more energy into the system to wake us up. And so the concentration and the mindfulness could be more useful. And, one of the ways is to do walking meditation, or walk very briskly and fast. There's various strategies. One is to, if you're doing mental noting, for example, is to note more frequently. Sometimes speeding up the rate of noting just takes more energy, more effort. And it might feel a little bit artificial, but it still gets the energy going and gets you kind of revved up a little bit, and some energy can come back. Sometimes there's a physical sense of vitality or aliveness that can come just by arousing it, kind of sitting up straighter and just kind of... There's also a little thing that can be done with the breathing. Sometimes I've had success with this. In that, at least for me, that kind of if I'm kind of on default mode with being with my breath, I often emphasize the exhalation and kind of a letting go, relaxation with the exhalation. And but relaxing tends to lower the energy level, and you can go too far in that direction. And for me, the inhalation, the upwelling and the lifting of the chest and the rising energy of the inhalation tends to bring more energy. And if I focus on that rather than focusing on the exhalation, that tends to kind of wake me up more. The exhalation puts me to more sleep or relaxes me more. The inhalation tends to bring more energy. And sometimes I have success bringing more energy in the system by having a little extra emphasis or attention or to the upwelling energy of the in-breath. Someone else? Your experience? Or lack of experience or difficulty? Yes?
One of the things that I discovered playing with faith was not just the faith I had in the sitting, but as a mom with two young kids, I have frequent interruptions, regardless of when I meditate. And I realized one of the things that came up for me about faith was just how much faith I had in my children, which was a really wonderful feeling for me of, when you talk about faith, that there's the faith in the sitting, but when I really felt the strength of faith was, when I'm sitting there very quietly and my son comes up trying to be not disturbing me and gently pats me three times on the back, and just that, that sense of wonderful joy.
Sweet. Yeah, with my parenting, the faith is not lacking, but the discernment is at times. And that's where I have to learn to be more discerning. Someone else? Difficulties you had with, yes?
Last week when we were sitting here, it felt really good, really solid. And when I went home, I meditated again, and it seemed like all the things that you said were really helping. And then the next day, I just zoned out. I couldn't stay awake, and it just all fell apart. But I sat there for 45 minutes, but mainly I was trying to wake up. I tried to breathe deeply. I tried to open my eyes. And the next night, it was kind of almost the same. And then I think I had a fairly mindful meditation the next day, but then I think I started getting a cold, and then I got a terrible headache every night. It just seemed like I just lost it. I couldn't meditate while I had that headache. And then I got depressed, and I thought, oh, look where your commitment is. You're supposed to be able to meditate when you're sick, too. But I couldn't. And then I just sort of felt like my faith went down a bit from that.
Yeah. Great report. So, what are some of the elements that, certainly the five faculties waxed and waned during the week, depending on these various conditions. And so it's interesting to track a little bit the cause and effect relationship. I don't know, but maybe coming after the last week's class, you were more inspired, so the next sitting had that inspiration. And who knows what happened next, that kind of, maybe you started getting sick or something. So faith is very important and discernment are very important. I think of faith and discernment as kind of the bottom of the pyramid that gives it all support. And if nothing else, you should fall back on faith and discernment to figure out what's going on. So there are times when you're so tired and things are such a mess, the mind is so chaotic and unable to focus, that maybe what you need to remind yourself of is faith and discernment. Discernment would be to recognize that, to be careful and notice when you're judging that, and when you're judging that, adding meaning to that. Oh, this means I'll never be able to meditate. This means that, X, Y, and Z. And it doesn't mean anything except that right now the mind's not concentrated. But we add all these layers to it. So the discernment is recognizing all the complications we have. Or discernment is recognizing that the wisdom, recognizing that that what's important, this is a very important key to mindfulness meditation, and is what's important is the continuity of your best effort. And the best effort, what it looks like, varies considerably depending on the energy and the wakefulness and all kinds of factors that come into play, what's happening in your daily life and all kinds of things. So at times when I sit down and I can hardly I can't concentrate at all, my mind is so wild, but I give it the best effort I have, and it doesn't look very good, the effort. And the other times, I'm very concentrated, I'm very still, I'm very focused, very mindful. And I might not actually be giving it much effort because I'm kind of coasting a little bit. Or maybe I'm giving a lot of good effort, and the effort looks kind of really sharp then. But I don't judge the effort of a good sitting with the effort of a bad sitting. It's just like sometimes that's all that's available. Was the continuity the best effort I can give it, which counts? So that's a piece of wisdom or discernment. Oh, the best, I'll just give it the best I have. And I know that when I'm sick, that my mind is not going to be very focused and it's not going to feel very satisfying. And I have the faith, the confidence, that simply giving it the best effort I can is what bears, one of the things that bears fruit over time. It's kind of like if you're constantly giving the best effort you have, one of the things you're doing is you're exercising the muscle of intention, of resolve, of determination. And even though you're not able to do much, it really counts. So that's wisdom, faith and discernment, faith and wisdom can come into play. Having faith, you know, that matters. No moment of mindfulness, no meditation practice is ever wasted. Even though it might feel like, you know, you're on Mars. And so sometimes I think having that as a foundation to fall back on, the faith part and the wisdom part, then we can begin looking at what can I do about the energy and the concentration part. What's wise to do about it? And so sometimes, you know, I've been sick and I haven't been able to be very focused in my meditation in the usual ways in which I practice. So I do something different. I don't practice the usual way I practice when I'm sick. One of the things I often practice with is I practice relaxing my muscles in my body. I do kind of a body scan and I'm just relaxing my muscles. And there's a kind of agitation that sometimes is there when I'm sick that adds to the difficulty of being focused. And when I relax my body, it tends to settle the mind a little bit. And it also feels very healing for my body. So, you know, I'll do that for a while. Or I'll do walking meditation sometimes when I'm very agitated. You know, just get up and do walking meditation. And that seems to contain it all and help me with being present and developing mindfulness. So by tracking a little bit the five faculties, you can kind of see where maybe the emphasis needs to be to give you support and the support you need in order to continue the best you can. And, you know, again, maybe think of it as a pyramid with faith and wisdom at the base. So you can always fall back on that. That's like the baseline. You always fall back on that. And then from there, you can build up in the concentration and the energy and the mindfulness. Does that make sense? Yes?
The first couple of days when we started this, I sort of was like not really wanting to do it, but I was only doing it because I wanted to discipline myself. But now it's like I really look forward to it. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I've already done it. Crap. You know, like, can I do it again? But and I read something that's helped me. It's about useful thoughts when meditating. I don't know if that fits in, if I'm allowed to do that, but and one time this past week, I had this feeling of euphoria when I was meditating. And I had, you know, and it was like thoughts, though. I don't know if that's okay either. You know, like thoughts that I was thinking was bringing me that euphoria.
Uh-huh. Well, it's normal enough for human beings to think. So I would imagine people think in meditation too. I know I do. But the question in mindfulness meditation is, are you interrupting the continuity of the mindfulness practice in order to engage in the thoughts and be caught up in them? Or are you able to clearly observe, here's a human being who's thinking, this is what thinking is like? Are you able to clearly note and be aware that thinking is happening, or are you entangled with your thinking? And if you want to maintain, if what you're trying to do is practice mindfulness, you want to always, you know, and that's where faith is very important, or wisdom. Different people fall back on different ones. That it's useful, it's helpful in your life, in your practice, to at least in your meditation time, to use that in a disciplined way, to not get swept up in the currents of our thoughts and thinking, not to be engaged in. You'll still think. But you're going to be the observer of your thoughts, as opposed to the thoughts being the thoughts themselves. So chances are, if you had euphoria around your thoughts, you were quite probably identified and involved with those thoughts, is my guess. And so then it interrupts the continuity of the practice. Even though you might feel it, this is a great meditation, but it's not exactly meditating, it's just feeling great.
So if you have thoughts and you're observing that you know that you're observing the thought,
yeah,
but you still feel good, then that's different.
That's fine. You feel, you know, you're welcome to feel good. And then, as you're present for that, you might notice subtle things. Like you might notice subtler ways in which you're identifying with that pleasure, getting hooked by it, or be interested in it, or feel validated by it, or something. You know, we don't just leave it alone and just see it clearly for what it is. We're a little bit involved with it, and it gets more and more subtle as more subtle the meditation gets. But it's very important to see that. Because as long as you're subtly engaged and involved with anything, then the mind is captivated. The mind is caught by something. The mind is not free. And the principle we're looking for is we're looking for a mind that's totally free. And it's either faith or wisdom or past experience knows that a free mind is the most satisfying mind to have, not a mind that's connected to pleasure. Yeah.
Gail, what is the process of learning if you observe the mind?
The process of learning if you're observing your mind?
Yes. If I follow this method through learning, yeah, anything, and not in meditation time, what is the process of learning? You know, if I see a new thing, the same as meditation is a new practice.
Right.
What is the process of learning? Do I have to observe this? How do you learn anything? Is that the same?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, but from the point of view of vipassana practice, most of the learning you learn for yourself is what comes from your powers of observation and discernment. By clearly observing what's happening and seeing clearly what's there, you'll learn everything you need to know. And then you can always read books or hear Dharma talks or to get instructions that can kind of help you kind of look more carefully and know what to look for. But the learning mostly happens from your own, by paying very careful attention to your immediate direct experience. Yes?
I seem to do best when I keep it simple. It just gave me too much to think about. You know, if I'm going to distance myself from my thoughts and notice them, but I have this agenda of thinking about these five elements, it felt intrusive. I didn't know how to do both and make use of it. Uh-huh. It just seemed like they were interesting concepts, but I didn't feel I went as far in the balance that I like.
Uh-huh. Could be. I think it could take a while to learn how to incorporate these, so they're kind of second nature. But I think the homework I said three times in the course of the sitting. You know, it wasn't constant. Don't do that. It didn't say constantly monitor the five faculties. Three times seems pretty innocent compared to how many times we think about what we're going to have for dinner, or, you know, how many times we judge our meditation, or, you know, and just to periodically monitor what's going on, kind of take a kind of step back in a sense and monitor what's happening here, and, you know, realize that for the last 10 minutes, I seem like I'm just drifting a lot in my thoughts. I'm not really applying much energy here. I'm not really applying myself much. Is there some way that I can apply myself more fully here with what I'm doing? And so that little analysis, a very brief analysis, it might be a little bit thoughts involved, then teaches you to kind of, okay, let me rev up the energy, the application here. Let me really get serious here. And realizing maybe the earlier and you weren't so serious. I mean, I sit down to meditate sometimes, and it takes me a while to realize I'm not that serious. You know, it's kind of an automatic pilot. I do it, you know, so much. And I'm kind of an automatic pilot. And so at some point I realize that, or I kind of scan, what's going on in meditation? I kind of step back, and what's happening here? Oh, I'm just kind of going on automatic here. I think I need to get a little more serious or a little bit more, you know, committed or a little bit more resolved. So then there's an increased energy or application that happens at that point. So, you know, and if you're unfamiliar with these concepts, maybe it's harder. You're more likely to think a lot about it and to wonder what's going on. And thinking too much about these things can be a hindrance. And
But do we agree that not mindfulness when one is judging the sit?
Judging and monitoring are two different things. So judging would be deciding whether something's good or bad. A monitoring or discernment would be recognizing what's skillful or what's helpful and what's not helpful, what's needed to do in the course of the meditation. So if you're sitting here and you realize that you're tired and or you don't have much energy, and you judge it as being, you know, bad and yourself as being bad, that's completely unnecessary. But if there's discernment, oh, here's a human being who's tired or doesn't have much energy, and in order to continue with the mindfulness in a clear way, having a little more energy would be helpful. Is there some simple way, that I can get more energy going, more application, get more serious, more, and make more endeavoring? Then we do that. And if it's not some simple way, if you're putting yourself through contortions to have more energy, and getting tight and contracted, then that's the wrong way to go. Then you use your discernment. The discernment is always monitoring. So you're like if you're doing this approach to meditation, where you're trying different approaches, trying to develop different things. Part of the function of discernment is to notice the consequences of that on the state of your quality of your mind. And if you're trying, like, let's say you feel like you don't have enough concentration. So then you try to focus on having more concentration to develop that for a while, more specifically, maybe by just hanging in there with the breath or counting the breath. There's various ways of developing concentration. But you try to develop that concentration. And you realize after a while that as you're doing this, you're getting more and more tense. So it's a function of discernment to recognize, oh, I'm getting tense. And then notice, oh, it's because I'm really striving. I'm bearing down and trying to become concentrated. And rather than relaxing into a concentrated state, I'm tensing into a concentrated state. And that's not useful. So that's not useful to get more and more tense as I meditate. So that's not the right way to develop more concentration. So let's see if I can relax and find a different way. So that would be the function of discernment. So it's kind of monitoring what's going on. Now, some people monitor all the time, and they'll never relax. So part of the principle for monitoring oneself in meditation is the process of monitoring helping you to get more settled and more peaceful, more calm, more still? Is it helping develop the five faculties, for example? So that's part of the function of discernment, just notice that. If it's not, then you have to change the way you're doing it. Maybe stop doing it for a while. And at different times, different people, different, you know, circumstances, different applications of practice are what's needed. There are times where the best approach to practice is to do absolutely nothing at all except be present. Just be present. I'll, you know, come what may. Just be present. Just be present. Be present. What's happening? Just focus on just being. And that's a very valid way of practicing at certain times. But other times, you might want to have more applied, active form of application in meditation, where you're monitoring and then making adjustments. And so, for this intermediate class, what I'm focusing on here for the intermediate class is those active sides of meditation where you're actually applying yourself and monitoring and making adjustments and noticing and, you know, using discernment to help you. And I'm not saying you should do this all the time as part of your mindfulness meditation, but you should know that this is part of the tools that you have for doing the practice. And you have to have the discernment to know whether you need to do more of the kind of choiceless awareness, kind of just relax and being approach sometimes, or whether you need to kind of apply yourself more and be more engaged and all that. And so, for example, for me, there was a period in my practice where I'd done a lot of Vipassana practice, and then I stopped doing Vipassana for quite a while. And what I was doing more Zen practice, which very simplistically was described, I was just practicing being, just being. Not adding anything, not being anything, just being present. And what I found was that if I did that, as I continued with this being meditation, that I kind of got to a plateau where the practice didn't seem to deepen any further. And so I recognized that and said, well, that's interesting, and I could just be that way in the plateau for a long time. But in order to let the practice deepen, I then switched the practice from a being practice to a knowing practice, kind of recognizing and knowing, developing the mindfulness, clear recognition, discernment of what's actually going on here. And even though it's a little active, it's the activity that actually let me go into greater stillness. I'm just making this up on the spot here, so maybe it's not a good analogy, but maybe it's kind of the analogy of maybe you'll help me with the analogy. I'll give you kind of my idea. I can imagine, you know, if you might, some people might do exercise, maybe go to the gym and exercise. And it's activity, it's work, you sweat, and, you know, you ache, and just a lot of effort has to go in there. But because of that effort of making, your body has a greater capacity after that to be still, or to be toned, or to be something. If you just didn't exercise, didn't put that effort in, then, you know, if you used to be a couch potato, then the body actually never gets that inner toning or tautness or whatever, this energy or centering or something that comes with the exercises that, you know, doesn't, you know. So, I mean, the point is to be relaxed, just be a couch potato, you think. But you actually be more deeply relaxed if you actually have a toned body, if you exercise some. Is that making some sense? So the same thing with the mind. Sometimes you need to exercise the mind and engage it to be able to take it to a deeper level. You know, you don't want to be like, you know, be a couch potato of meditators. You know, just kind of zone out. And I know people who've been years kind of just zoning out in meditation, and it's kind of feels kind of vaguely, you know, okay, and you know, it feels like, you know, like they're more relaxed in their daily life, and it's kind of like this complacent kind of numb or empty kind of place they go to for a long time, and just it seems like they're meditating, but not much is happening, and what they need to do is actually really apply themselves more and develop. And then after they develop that strength, see, the five faculties are supposed to be transformed into the five powers. And so five faculties are, in a sense, five capacities, potentials we have. When they're developed, they become these powers within us. And it's having these strengths within us that are one of the things that support the mind and going into the deepest levels of letting go and relaxation or peace or stillness that's possible. Am I making some sense? Is this all relevant? Is this relevant to your concern? Is it? Sometimes I go on and on, and I wonder. Yes?
I had a question about loving kindness and how it related to the five practice. At one top point during the week, I was feeling really overwhelmingly sad, and sort of being with the emotion was too much for me, and kind of out of the blue, you know, loving kindness kind of kicked in, and for me that worked at that point, but I wasn't quite sure then, you know, putting it into the five faculties that we were working on this week, how it related.
I mean, the first connection that I can see is that you use your discernment to see, well, I'm feeling quite sad. You're recognizing that. And you're recognizing that the mindfulness practice you're doing is not working in this, because it seems like you're getting more and more lost in the sadness and we're kind of drowning in it or whatever. It's just you're not able to develop mindfulness and see clearly what's going on. It doesn't seem to be very useful. That's, you know, whatever. So some discernment is functioning there, and it's important to have the discernment. And then with that discernment, you're saying, well, you know, what else could I do? And someone might say, well, maybe I need to have an antidote and apply the antidote so I'm not caught by this particular thing. And when it's settled, then I'll go back to the regular mindfulness practice. Or it might be that with a sadness, I tend to be lost in my agitated thoughts a lot. What I need to do is to settle the mind, concentrate the mind, still the mind. And so I'll do a concentration practice. And it happens that loving kindness practice is a concentration practice. So let's do that for a while. And so you're developing that concentration. Or it could be that the loving kindness practice inspires a certain level of faith. And maybe when people are sad, sometimes they feel a lot of doubt is easy to come up, or they feel not inspired, or they feel, you know, I can imagine that faith sometimes is a nice balance. Oh, I'm drowning this sadness and not making any progress. I don't understand why I should even practice when I'm sad, and, you know, it's not helping. But then if you get reinfused with faith, oh, yeah. If I really apply this practice well, it can help overcome grief, sadness, lamentation, and all these things. So, oh yeah, and so, oh yeah, and oh yeah, I can. I'm sure I can do it. I can do it. The Buddha said I can do it. The teacher said I could do it. I think I can do it. Okay, I'm going to try again. And then there's more faith, there's more energy, and then lo and behold, sadness doesn't get in the way anymore. So. I can see the five faculties coming into play in the analysis. You're trying to figure out what's going on and what you need to do. It can be useful. Yeah?
So one thing I notice for myself is kind of trying to cultivate more faith in the practice in general, kind of some self-doubt. And so I read some inspirational passages, and I tried some various other things. And then a couple days later, I noticed that I was also kind of inadvertently cultivating maybe some attachment or sort of desire for some mindful, some more mindful state. And that I was kind of predicating my faith on attachment to certain, to the ideal of being mindful. And I was just wondering what, if you have any recommendations about how to avoid that.
Well, the first thing is to be very honest about it, to see it. And I think all of us will probably, sooner or later, find that there's some attachment involved in the very practice we're doing. Attachment to some ideal, attachment to some states, attachment to, you know, something. And sometimes that attachment can actually fuel our practice along. And so part of the discernment is to notice, is this attachment helping me develop concentration and mindfulness and all that? Or is it hindering? If it's helping, then maybe you don't want to be in a hurry to let go of that attachment. Sooner or later, you have to let go of it. Sooner or later, you have to let go of it. But you don't have to necessarily let go of it the first chance you get. And so, you know, you can also be relaxed, you know. So, but seeing it clearly for what it is very important. And I have a lot of faith that the mindfulness practice is self-correcting. So meaning if you do mindfulness practice, if there's any ways in which we do the practice which is off, sooner or later it will become obvious to you that it's off and you'll have to kind of adjust. So, you know, the other thing I might say about inspiration, it can be very helpful to have some renewed faith and inspiration from various sources. And I think I recommend it, even reading a little passage to get some inspiration. Some people use that as a crutch, however, and they become dependent on always getting inspiration. And so they're holding on, they're always looking for something outside of them which is going to infuse them with motivation. And so they're constantly going, needing to get these hits. And that's a kind of attachment in itself. And sooner or later, it's really good to practice without any external inspiration at all. And you no longer have any support at all. But really, don't do this in a hurry. Don't do it right away when you're new to practice. But at some point, it might be good just to be left completely alone. So for me, for example, I practiced Zen practice for pretty constantly for about 7 years. Been to monasteries and lots of retreats and sesshins and all that. And then I went to Thailand to do my first Vipassana retreat. And one of the surprises for me was that one of the things that happened there was that I was given this little hut in the edge of the monastery to practice alone in. And no one was watching me. And there's no one practicing with me. And no one keeping track of whether I was sitting or not, or whether I was, you know, goofing off. And, you know, I went to go to sleep early or take a nap or, you know, eat a cookie or, you know, whatever. You know, I could do whatever I wanted to. And I realized how much I'd been dependent, happily, I would say, beforehand, with the practicing together in a group, with the discipline that provided. And it was very revealing to me to see what it was like to practice alone without any inspiration, any getting anything from outside. And to discover, what I had to do was I had to discover the motivation to practice from within. And at some point, if a person practices for a long time, it's helpful to go someplace or practice in such a way that you really have to find the motivation and the meaning of practice all from within. And being one way to do that is to be left radically alone. Go practice alone. Go do a self-retreat. You know, go practice 10 days or a month, you know, in some cabin in the woods. The rule about self-retreats, however, is never go into a self-retreat that's longer than any organized retreat you've been on. So. Yes?
This all seems so much about me and my... This is sort of focus on your practice and all the techniques about it and all that. It seems so. It doesn't feel very spiritual.
Oh. The five spiritual faculties. What would make it look spiritual? Or feel spiritual?
I don't know, but it just seems like I'm working on myself.
What's wrong with that?
I don't know. It's a little...
Who else are you going to work on? I'm sure your spouse doesn't want to be worked on. Leave me alone.
It just feels peculiar.
Well, I appreciate that you bring that up. The mindfulness meditation, which this intermediate class is focusing on, is very centered or focused on the inner subjective process of the individual. For what purpose are we doing that? What is a larger sense of spirituality that's connected to? And it might be that we realize that as long as we are attached and clinging and filled with defenses and confusion and don't have discernment, don't have faith, that we're not going to connect to some larger sense of spiritual reality or sacredness that we feel is important. And so it's kind of like we're doing the grunt work to prepare ourselves for some deeper spiritual connection. So there definitely is this kind of inward, very personal aspect to the practice. As we do this personal work, because mindfulness is self-correcting, sooner or later we'll come across the ways in which either the practice or we in other ways are self-centered in unhealthy ways. The attachment to me, myself, and mine is one of the attachments that practice is meant to overcome. So sooner or later you have to face that and deal with that. And when you no longer have attachment to me, myself, and mine, then, or be able to see through it, then you enter into a whole different way of maybe relating to the world and to the world around you. Unfortunately, because of it's such a personal focus in the mindfulness meditation, we close our eyes mostly and we're kind of inward and all that, it lends itself sometimes to a certain degree of narcissism. And it's sometimes very hard to distinguish narcissistic involvement with spiritual practice and genuine self-exploration and self-transcendence kind of practice. And it's hard for even a teacher to pick it up in someone else. And sometimes I suspect, that person's not really... People come to me and they just want to talk to me about their spiritual practice and, it's my practice and I'm doing this and I've had this experience and I'm working on that, And after a while I said, this person is just obsessed with themselves. And most of when people come and talk to me, they talk about their own practice, right? So mostly it seems healthy. So it takes a while for me to catch on. Wait a minute. There's something off here. This is all, there's something really off about this way, the way this person seems to be blind to the rest of the world, or it seems to like a lot of ego attachment to this. So it can't, that's a danger. But hopefully the practice is self-correcting. Now, it also requires some discernment on your part to recognize first discernment that I think is necessary is what do you think spiritual practice is? You don't have to answer that now, but if that's a concern of yours, what is spiritual practice? What is the practice you want to be connected to? What's the purpose of that practice? Once you've decided that for yourself, then you can look at what is the practice that supports that. And then you might go sniff around the Vipassana scene and say, in what way can those particular practices of Vipassana and the techniques and the skills there support me in that purpose that I want to follow through on? And if your deepest purpose in life has no connection to what we're cultivating here, go do something else. We don't want you. I mean, we want you, but we have so much respect for your time that and your humanity that, I'd rather you engage fully in what is helpful. And so if you're not sure, then maybe you come and talk to a teacher and explore it. So I can imagine some people feeling that they are self-centered And the antidote to it is not further self-centeredness, you know, kind of self. If someone is narcissistic, it might not be very valuable to do kind of vipassana practice. What they maybe should do is compassion practice, service, go out in the world to be of service for a while. You know, spend 5 years working for Habitat of Humanity, and then come back and talk to us, you know, clarify that part or something. Or maybe it's some other kind of practice. It's not so engaged in the intricacy, the details of one's inner psyche. But maybe it's more like a shikantaza practice that just kind of opens, you know, in a much more empty kind of way to life as it is. So there's all these choices people need to make. And I don't know any way to get around that. I would like to encourage people to start being discerning about their lives, their spiritual lives, and the choices they make, and to be able to sort out why they make different choices and what is a useful choice to make. Steve?
Is that why the first practice the Buddha taught everybody was generosity, so people wouldn't get so self-centered when they came to meditate?
Well, that's my theory, or at least my interpretation of that, that the Buddha taught generosity and ethics so that the foundation of the practice is based on healthy relationships to the people around us. And so that's presupposed when you start doing vipassana practice. Though we don't, you know, a lot of people come to vipassana practice without the foundation of generosity and ethics. And so, in Asia, vipassana practice is considered the cream of, in Southeast Asia, the cream of Buddhist practice, the pinnacle. And they think it's really weird. Some people do in Asia. They think it's really strange that, you can come just walk off the street, you know, in Redwood City and, you know, get instruction in vipassana practice. You need to prepare yourself for that. There was a Chinese friend of mine, Chinese Buddhist, who was very devout. He was Buddhist, and really was devoting her life to Buddhism and Buddhist practice and Buddhist study. And at one point I asked her if she meditated, or how she meditated, or something about her meditation. And she said, oh no, I'm preparing myself to meditate. I'm not worthy enough yet. I was kind of amazed. You know, I was really in awe of her. That she was very intent, and she wasn't being passive in this process, but she was preparing herself to get her ethics and her generosity and various things in place. So that she can do this, you know, meditation practice. So the presupposition is that we have this foundation of healthy relationships with the world around us as part of it. Also, traditionally, vipassana practice was mostly a practice done by monastics. And monastics also presupposes that you're practicing in a community with all kinds of community relationships built into your life. So it's very hard then to get, you know, your life is much more, it involves a lot more activities than just mindfulness meditation. And so in the balance, if you look at the whole picture, in the balance, it looks like you're doing some things which look, you know, pretty personally directed, inwardly directed. But in the balance, compared to all the other things you're doing, it doesn't look like your overall life is going in a self-centered direction. Or perhaps the motivation, you know, the Buddha can be, the Buddha can be you said, was a phenomenally self-centered kind of guy. I mean, he left his family, his child. You know, he went off and engaged in these long, long practices and was completely kind of focused inwardly in this whole process. But he was able to come out of that and be of tremendous service to humanity. So there might be a time that inward direction is the appropriate thing to do. And it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be self-serving. It can be actually very selfish, very selfless, to spend a period of time, to renounce so much of our life, to renounce and sacrifice so many good, healthy things in our life, in order to spend some concentrated time, in order to become more of service to the world around us. And I've known people, many people, maybe you, many of you have the experience, of doing something like that for 10 days, you know, going on a 10-day retreat. And you don't read, you don't help anybody, you don't look at somebody, someone's crying next to you, you don't say, you know, can I help you, or here's a tissue. You know, you just leave them alone, you know, and you do, you know, I'm just focusing, you know, don't bother me, I'm doing my practice. But we do that because we're trying to purify and clarify our psyche. We come out of that 10-day having done that work, and then we're so much more available to be of service to the world around us than we were before. So it's strategic. So is it strategically useful to do this for a while? Is this at all? You look troubled.
Yeah, I feel bad.
Well, why?
Well, I'm sort of trying to reconstruct what you said. And I think I understand that. Well, I've been practicing for 15 years, so it's kind of a long time. And I've been practicing one way. And now I'm here and I'm learning some other things. And there's a sort of an awareness that I didn't have. I was just doing it differently.
Yeah.
And you know, I like to sit in the morning, and it feels good. It feels deeply good. And I think I do want to go deeper. And I think these techniques will, you know, deepen my practice. And I just wonder if people that just get these techniques, that's what they get, as opposed to nothing. I just wonder what, I wonder about everybody else who's just practicing Vipassana. I'm just concerned. I don't have the words for it.
I think you're asking very good questions. There's the last two sentences, or whatever the last was, the last long. I didn't follow, but I think
about wisdom and what wisdom is.
Great. That's the kind of questions you should be asking. Okay. Keep asking questions like that. Be discerning. Yes.
I wanted to say in connection with that I think meditation does seem spiritual to me because the inner observer, or whatever you want to call it, the one that is the mindfulness, is not self, really. It's outside of self. And, you know, it's not judgmental. It's just seeing, no matter whether you're seeing a murder or a kiss. And so it's really, that to me is the spiritual part, because it's that we're trying to develop, is to be that inner observer more of the time that is not self. And I think what it really feels like, spiritual part feels like it's a part of the spiritual whatever that's outside. So it's the part that's inside each of us that we're developing, and that part connects us to everything else in a very non-judgmental way. I don't know if that helps, but thank you.
Thank you.
To be continued.
You know, when you explained that, like my first thing, I wanted to say, my name is Carolina. I don't know your name.
Right.
So I feel a little more connected.
Okay. So, oh yes.
I have a question that's going to switch gear a little bit and deal with technique. During the last week, when I tried to have this recognizing mind, and it's part of the body, start to itch or ache, so I put my concentration on it, recognizing it, and I find that almost immediately when I do that, the feeling intensifies, and so I concentrate more, it's intensified more to the point where it's unbearable, and so I find that when I put my mind somewhere else, and I'm not feeling it much, I recognize it as much, then I feel better. So I'm not sure, you know, in a way, the instruction last week is that kind of develop concentration or something that seems to be present and seems to be pronounced at the time I did that. Just sort of how do you deal with that in real life? And I've heard from reading, you know, like Thich Nhat Hanh, who said if you put your mindfulness on the pain or suffering, then eventually, you know, the mindfulness will penetrate and then, you know, it will take care of them. But my experience was that the pain intensified.
But it was an itch? It was an itch?
Yeah, it's itch. I don't remember. I think it's either pain or itch.
I see. See, itches are great because you know you're not going to die from it. So it just, you just let it go, you know. Just you start crying and tearing and just like, it's pretty dramatic, but you know it's okay. It's just an itch. So it's a great place to kind of explore. I love it. Just, you know. So that I'm glad you bring this up, because this then would segue into what I was going to talk about today. When you pay attention to something in meditation, one of the things we want to do is to track. We want to see very clearly what happens to that when we're paying attention to it. We want to see what something is, and then we want to track how it changes. And it can change in one of three ways. It could go away, it can get weaker and go away. It can stay the same. And it can get stronger. And it's not your concern which way it goes. Your job is, can you continue to develop the non-reactive mindfulness to how it is, and to trust the process. As you do this, sometimes bringing attention to discomfort will make it stronger. Sometimes mindfulness is like a magnifying glass, and it's, you know, become much more sensitive to it. Sometimes it gets stronger because as we focus on it with attention, there's a lot of associated reactions, ideas, opinions, meaning that come into play. That is actually what's making it stronger. It's not necessarily that stronger by itself. So, I mean, a classic thing is for people sitting in meditation on retreat, or maybe here, and having a pain. They think, this is unbearable. How can I stand it anymore? And they better ring the bell, and oh, this is the worst, you know, and I'm going to die any minute now. And it just, and then they ring the bell. And you say, oh, good. And then you sit there for 10 seconds. It's still there, but it's not so bad. And somehow pain is not a psychologically neutral event. Often a lot of our psychology, our reactivity, feeds into the strength and weakness of pain. And so sometimes by focusing attention to something, it does get stronger. And so in dedicated mindfulness practice, you would probably just hang in there and just follow it. And sooner or later, it would probably pass. But it's not a linear path from worse to better. Sometimes things go from worse to worse, and then they get better. You know, it's not a linear path from worse to better. It goes up and down. So this is what I want to talk about today. And maybe we should do it, maybe try to do it as a kind of guided meditation, and then I'll talk some more. If you'd like to stand a little bit, because you've been sitting now for a while, you're welcome to stand for a few seconds. Using some kind of technique here. And techniques can be kind of cumbersome to apply with the five faculties, for example. But I think they become second nature, and there's very practical, obvious things that probably in some way or other in your life you're already using it without thinking about it. I mean, I can imagine if someone decides to go for a hike, say go hike up Windy Hill or go up some kind of mountain, somehow or other, without thinking about it, you're probably the five faculties are coming into play with that activity. And if you don't have much confidence in yourself in getting to the top, then, you know, you start lagging behind, feeling kind of down about it. And then your friend you're hiking with says, oh, you can do it. And then you feel buoyed, and suddenly you have the confidence because they said you can do it. And, you've made it halfway, and you realize you made it halfway. Oh, good, I can make it the rest of the way. And then suddenly you have more energy again because the faith factor, some kind of faith or confidence that come into play. Or you feel after a while that maybe what you need to do is to be more focused on the goal of getting to the top of the mountain and not spend so much time kind of smelling the flowers and walking around. And you got to get serious and apply yourself and you really make more effort. Maybe you need to walk a little bit faster, a little bit harder, take longer steps. Or maybe you need to be more mindful or discerning in the process of it. Maybe, you know, you're going up the mountain and there's a lot of, you know, rough rocks in the path. So you realize, well, I'm going to make up this mountain. I need to be more discerning of what's in front of me, really seeing, being discerning where I'm going to place my foot. So I don't know if I just, you know, made the analogy very convincing, but I think that you can probably do better. But the idea is that probably in some way, the five faculties are faculties you already have, that you're already automatically kind of incorporating in part of your life. You're driving your car, and you say, well, that was a close one. I better have to be more mindful. You know, so you don't have that near, you know, accident again. And I've driven that way, and you say, I better be more mindful and pay more attention here. This is not so much like a heavy-duty technique that you're adding to your life, as it is recognizing a capacity you already have, and you're already using probably in different areas of your life. And it becomes second nature in recognizing how to augment and support this. Even people who practice so-called non-dual meditation practices, where you're not really practicing any technique at all, will probably, if they're really honest, will notice that probably these five faculties are coming into play in the background anyway. And probably there's some way in which we're kind of adjusting them anyway in the background. I've noticed that sometimes people doing radically different practices from like Vipassana are sometimes the five faculties are they're still adjusting them and working with them, but it's almost unconscious. And because the rhetoric or the focus or the main definition of the practice is different, then they don't really recognize that they're already doing kind of second nature. Just to some degree, a little bit. Does that make sense? Okay. So if you feel like it sounds like a heavy technique now, maybe just have a little bit of faith that as you get a little bit more hang of it, you'll become second nature. So take a comfortable upright posture. Softly close your eyes. And then we'll sit quietly together for about just a few minutes. And you can just get yourself settled and concentrated and present in whatever way is best for you. And then as a prelude to this next guided meditation, another analogy. And that's the analogy of shaking someone's hand as a greeting. And you might recognize there's a range of ways in which you can shake someone's hand, or someone might shake your hand. There can be the limp handshake where the person's barely present. They're already maybe off and talking to someone else. There's a person who kind of squeezes your hand so hard that it hurts afterwards. And then there's a kind of the middle way where someone is, you feel like they're really present. Their handshake really expresses real presence, but also respect and also not too much, not too little. There's a loving, gentle but a very direct, complete presence in a handshake. So it's the same way with attention. Awareness could be hesitant, weak, perfunctory, or awareness can be a very aggressive, when we pounce on the breath, bear down hard on what we're paying attention to. Or it can be the middle way, where it's very clearly, fully, directly present for what's there, really greeting it, really offering a direct presence. But it's not overbearing, it's not straining or pushing, it's not holding back, just fully there for it. So what I'd like to ask you to do next is to see if you can bring that level of attention to the thing I'm going to ask you to pay attention to. And that is, see if you can adjust or find a way to really connect to your breathing, to your breath. And then once you've made that solid connection, thorough, direct connection with the breath, then see if you can sustain that attention, sustain the application of attention on the breath over time. Hang in there with it. And as you hang in there with your breathing, notice that part of your breathing, your experience of breathing, which is changeable, that changes as you pay attention to it. And notice how the experience of breathing changes over time. And then letting go of the breathing. Find some experience, find the strongest sensation in your body. It doesn't have to be that strong. But find the strongest sensation in your body right now, aside from the breath. And bring a real connection to there. Just let your initial connectedness be that middle way where it's firm and present. And then sustain the attention to that place in your body. Hang in there. noticing it, feeling it, exploring it. And notice how, if at all, it changes over time. What happens to it as you watch it? Let your attention roam around the edges of it and into the middle of it, and feeling the size, the texture, the shape of the sensation, the details of exactly what kind of sensation it is, and as you do this, notice how it changes. If it disappears, then find another strong sensation to do this with. Sometimes a sensation or in the body can, in a sense, disappear, but it seems to be replaced by something else. It seems to morph into something else. If it does, if it morphs into something else, then stay with it. Stay focused and track the changes. Stay with the strongest sensation in your body, whatever it might be. If one disappears, then find the next one that's strongest. Or if it morphs into something else. And if the mind wanders away, then have that initial reconnection to the experience be complete or thorough. In the same way that a handshake might be thorough. Not too little, not too much. And then hang in there. So what you're experimenting with, exploring, is making that connection with your experience, whatever you're paying attention to in your body. The direct experience, letting go of your concepts and ideas about it, and just feeling it directly, making that initial connection thorough. And then sustaining the attention. And then as you do so, tracking what happens to that experience. Notice its qualities. Get to know it better. Notice any changing aspect of that experience. If it gets stronger, that's fine. Don't worry about it. Be content that you're seeing change. You're seeing a change to become stronger. So there are three principles or concepts in Vipassana practice that came into play in that little exercise. One has to, two of them have to do with the kind of attention that's needed. And there are technical terms for these, but the English translation is usually the initial application of thought. And then the sustained initial application of attention. And the sustained application of attention. So when we're ready to apply our attention someplace, the mind's drifted away, or we notice, for example, that maybe there's an itch or a pain somewhere, or some sensation is predominant. At some point, there's kind of a decision made, okay, this is what I'm going to pay attention to. Pay attention to my breath, that itch, that knee aching or something. So there's kind of a vague awareness that this needs attention. But in a sense, you turn your mindfulness to that, to really be there for it. And that initial application of mindfulness is very important, how you do that. And you might experiment a little bit, notice how you do that. Are you doing it? Some people kind of do it very hesitantly. Some people do it reluctantly. Some people do it with all kinds of attitudes of, oh no, not again, or, you know, great, like, you know, whatever. All these ways. Kind of like the variations of the handshake. Some people really bear down and push on the experience and pounce on it. Just with the breath, for example, there are wide variations of ways which people, the way in which people connect with the object of the breath. So what you want to do is you want to have that initial application of thought. That's an old-fashioned way of translating the term, but initial application of attention is a very important quality. And you want to work a little bit and find kind of a middle way, an appropriate way that's full and thorough and complete, but not too much, not too little. Okay, here I am, going to be here with that experience. And then the next is the sustained application of attention, where you're going to maintain, hang in there, maintain the attention over time. It's a kind of a different kind of effort or different activity of mind to then sustain the attention once you've made that full connection to the experience. And to sustain it over time is very important. Now, one of the One way that Vipassana practice is described, which I'm not very fond of this description, but it's the way it is. It's and that is that Vipassana practice involves getting to know, investigating, being very mindful of the objects of awareness. And this is contrasted sometimes with a practice that focuses on just the nature of awareness itself. So if you have, so what you're really trying to see clearly the nature of your, the particular object that you're paying attention to. So you want to really connect to some object. So if you're doing with the breath, you want to connect to that object, to the breath, and really see the nature of that breathing. What's going on there? If you have a pain somewhere, we hear a sound or any experience at all, you want to connect to that object and really see that object for what it is, really explore that. And the deepening of Vipassana practice is a deepening of our insight, of our seeing into the nature of these objects of experience. So you really want to connect to these objects very clearly. A sound. So you were, okay, I'm going to be mindful of sound, so you turn your attention really there for the sound. Are you open to it? There's different ways of describing how you might do it, but at some point there's a kind of a choice. Okay, I'm going to connect to this. I'm going to open to it. I'm going to receive it. Whatever the understanding you have for what you're doing. And you want to do it thoroughly. And then you want to sustain the attention to really get to know that experience really well as a direct experience, not as a concept. So you might even hear, you might hear the sound of traffic outside. And then you don't want to start wondering, was that a truck or was it a Harley Davidson, or that person needs a muffler job, or all these ideas of that probably that person was driving in second gear and they should have been in third gear by now, or all these ideas about their driving. That's getting involved in concepts, interpretations, and what you want to do is stay in the direct sensory experience of what that sound is like in the ear. Oh, vibration, humming. What's that direct experience like? Pain, if you feel discomfort in your body. There's all this meaning and interpretations and ideas we have around the pain. What we're trying to do in Vipassana is to get behind the concepts and ideas to the actual direct experience and then to explore and get to know that in great detail, very refined, looking very deeply in it. So the Vipassana practice in Vipassana, Vipassana means to see. And V is a prefix of intensification. It's to see deeply or clearly or with strength. So we want to see deeply into the objects of attention. And as we're paying attention to something, we don't want to be there kind of vaguely there. And we don't want to be caught up in the subjective experience of meditation, how relaxed we are or how concentrated we are and all that. Even though we're tracking this to some degree, we don't want to just get caught up in that world either, which you can be. It's part of the danger, what we've talked about so far. It's all in the service of, so that you can really be there fully, presently, mindfully, concentrated with real, appropriate effort for really seeing what's actually your experience. What is this? And discerning, this is where discernment becomes very important, discerning the difference between your concepts of that experience, your interpretations, you're assigning a meaning to it, versus in and of itself the direct felt sense of the experience. And then what is it? What's the nature of that felt sense experience? To develop concentration on that experience, to deepen your concentration there, and deepen your insight in the nature of that experience. And there's a lot to be said about insight, but right now I want to focus on two aspects. One is tracking how it morphs or changes as you're with it. So the breath is fascinating because it's a constant changing morphing going on. One inhalation, there's a number of different changing sensations that come in, that rise, are subtle and get stronger, then disappear and change. And you can change, you can watch and track how one sensation transforms itself into another, or moves into another, or cascades into another, or it's followed by another. You can watch the track that changes. If you're following a discomfort in your body, you can track how it changes. If you're following an emotion, if you really feel and connect to that emotion in the body and how it is, how does it change? as you're present for it. It'll change. It'll move. It'll morph. So emotions often in the body will move around the body. It might start off as being, you know, some anger in your jaw, and you're there feeling the tightness in your jaw, and pretty soon it seems to morph in a sense into a burning kind of fiery rage in your belly. It seems like you just morph. That's what it became. Wow, it's just, you know, I was sitting here to get calm, and now it's just, you know, and great. So you get to follow that, and you're tracking how it changes, and you're tracking it without getting caught up now with the meaning or the interpretation or, you know, your expectations or your desires for that particular experience. You're just tracking what's going on, getting a sense of how it changes and what morphs. This is very helpful can be very helpful for concentration. The other thing you want to track, want to notice, you want to see, look at it very carefully to see if you can discern anything about the experience that's changeable, that's in flux, that's arising and passing. Don't strain, don't squint to see that. If you know, sometimes it won't be obvious that things are transitory or have some element of being in flux as part of their experience. So don't strain, but the sustained application of attention is also there. You want to kind of noticing what happens to that experience as you're there, as you're watching it. What's its nature as you're there with it? So the deepening of vipassana practice is a deepening of attention to the objects of attention. In order to do that, you have to cultivate a lot of concentration. So concentration develops as you do this. And as the concentration develops, you can penetrate and see more and more deeply into that experience. So when I was in Burma with Upandita, the instructions we had was to keep a little notebook. And at the end of every sitting, we had to jot down what our experience of the sitting was. And it was very instructive, because and then we reported our experience to him. And what we were trained to do was to report in a very particular way. That was to only report what the direct experience was that we were having and how that direct experience was changing over time. What happened as we paid attention. Our tendency was to show up with reports like this. I was sitting there, and I had this terrible pain in my knee, and it was really hard, and I started thinking about my mother and the difficulties I had, and I felt really discouraged. I was wondering why I was in Burma, and you know, and if you said something like that, you know, he just kicked you out. You know, get lost, kid. It was a fine experience to have, but that's not how you reported it. What you had to say was, you know, something like, I sat down to meditate. I directed my attention to the breath. I was able to stay with a few breaths, and then a lot of knee pain arose for me. I directed the attention to knee pain. I was there for a while, and I could feel it throbbing, got stronger as I paid attention to it. And then a strong feeling of discouragement arose. And I noted the discouragement. I felt it as a kind of constriction in my throat. And I hung out there for a while and stayed for quite a long time, and I stayed there with constriction, exploring and being with it. After a while, I felt some resistance to the constriction. I noted that, and then went away and went back to the constriction. After a while, I got bored with it, and I noted the boredom, and boredom went away, and I stayed with the constriction. And after a while, I started assigning meaning to the constriction. I noted the assigning of meaning to constriction, and it went away and went back to the constriction. And then self-pity arose. I noted the self-pity, and it stayed for a long time. And then I came for the interview. This is kind of like a reporter reporting, you know, anthropologist from Mars, saying this is a direct experience, as opposed to me, myself, and mine. Oh, it's me. I'm having such a hard time here, and I'm wondering, you know, this is so hard for me, and I don't know if I can manage this very well. And you know, anytime, you know, it's my knee is troubling me so much. You know, my knee. You're supposed to say there was a strong, intense pain in my. You can say my knee. You can say it in shorthand, my knee. But you don't want to say you don't want to use language where you're applying me, myself, and mine concepts to it. You don't want to get caught up in the concepts, interpretations of the experience. So the way we were trained in the reporting in a journal was to, and also reporting to him, was to report what the immediate direct experience was before all the different concepts and ideas and interpretations and me-making and I-making and all that came into play around it. It was fine to be discouraged. If you came and said, oh, I feel so discouraged, it's a hard meditation. That's not a useful way of meditating with that kind of attitude. What was useful was noting, I noticed discouragement. It was hard to be with the discouragement. And so I tried, I applied myself more. I noticed the discouragement as a sense of kind of dropping of energy out of my upper part of my body and feeling kind of empty. And I noticed it like that. And after a while, it changed and it transformed into something else. We get caught up in identification with it and in the conclusion about what it means that it's there, taking it very personal. And the training we got was to stop, drop out of taking it personal, drop out of making the interpretation, and just stay with the facts as they actually are. So you're sitting there and your difficulty staying with your breathing, the concentration is not very much there. Then what you're mindful of is, okay, this is a moment where there's not much concentration. The mind is agitated, distracted. As opposed to saying, oh, the mind is distracted and I'm such a bad meditator and this is probably the wrong country to be meditating in, and you know, and all these conclusions. You go to the teacher and say, oh, you know, we make all these stories. We get into the story around what's going on. We drop out of any story making around the experience. And there's a training just to be with the direct experience as it actually is. And the unfolding of Vipassana practice is the deepening of seeing clearly, moment by moment, what the direct experience is. It's very freeing. So you can probably imagine, you know, because so much of our life is made up of story making and making things personal and all this stuff. And so the training with Upandita was you had to report that way. Since you had to report that way, then it predisposed us to pay attention to our experience that way in meditation. And it was very helpful for me. Then to be as try to track and be present for the direct experience as it is. Is it making sense? Does it not make sense to someone? Actually, that's the way I should ask. I should stop asking this question. Does it make sense? That's not a useful question, is it? For whom doesn't it make sense? For whom doesn't this make sense? That's the interesting question. Yes?
I'm trying to understand it.
Great. I'm trying to explain it.
I think I have to think about it some more.
So one of the foundation stones of Vipassana practice is learning to distinguish between the concepts we have of our experience and the experience itself. And what we're trying to do is to connect our attention to the experience, not the concept. Vipassana always involves, one teacher said, Vipassana always involves a real object, as opposed to an interpretation or an assumption or projection of what's there. So we're always trying to find a real object for the attention to rest on and see clearly what's there. Now, say that you're sitting here and you're meditating and you start having a projection about who you are. Oh, I'm a terrible meditator. Then you can make that the object of attention. Oh, here's a thought. Oh, I'm a terrible meditator. That thought is a real object if we see it as a thought in and of itself, as opposed to believing that and getting wrapped up in the story about what it means I'm a bad meditator and, you know, getting carried down by it. In the book Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, Joseph Goldstein has a chapter in there on titled something about concept. Does someone know the title? Anyway, he has a very nice chapter in there on this issue of the direct experience versus the concept of experience. And probably that book's in the library here. So why don't you, this is what I would like you to play with this next week, experiment with, this is described in the handout which is back there, and that is experiment with this thing about the way in which you initially connect to the object of attention, whether it's the breath or anything you're going to pay attention to. How do you connect with it? Can you find the appropriate or helpful way of really connecting that's not too much and not too little? but really fully there, like you're really going to be there for it. And then can you see what it takes? Experiment, work the muscle, experiment with what it's like then to sustain the attention over time with whatever it is you're paying attention to. Some people do the checklist approach to mindfulness. They're very good with initial application, but then they just kind of let it go. And then they pay attention to something else. But you really want to sustain, and so you can really see deeply. So you want to connect to something, and you really want to feel, experience, see, sense what this experience is. And as you do that, track any changes that you notice in that experience. Does it morph into something else? Does it fade away and disappear? Does it get stronger? Does it vibrate? Does it pulse? Does it flash in and out of existence? The closer you get to it with attention, the closer you can get in, really, probably more likely are to see that it has some quality of vibrating or energy or arising in and out of being or flashing in and out. And that seeing the impermanence, seeing the changing quality, is a very important aspect of Vipassana practice. So being sensitive to that and noticing that part of your experience can be very helpful as you practice deeper. So that's the instructions for this next week. If, yes, please.
Is this a different exercise from the exercise of letting go? In other words, you recognize the sensation and then let it go. Because what I just said, in the letting go exercise, would be applying the initial attention and
right.
then not sustaining.
Right, this is a different way of practicing. So this is however, you can let go of the concepts and the reactions you might have to that object. Any clinging you notice, you can let go of. But this is actually sustaining the attention. Sustaining attention does two things. It develops concentration. As long as you're doing mindfulness practice, you can't have too much concentration. So just don't worry about that. Just it develops concentration. And then it also... develops insight, seeing clearly what's there. So you want to look, what is this? So the question, the kind of silent question you can have is, what is this experience? And what happens to it as I attend to it? What is it? What is the experience and what happens to it? Does that make sense? And if this seems really foreign idea to some of you, just a minute, and if it's very, very radically different than how you've been practicing, that's okay. Give it the benefit of doubt for a week. It's not a long time. And then next week you can go back to the way you were. Is that okay? Please.
What is the definition of object?
Anything that awareness is aware of. That's all.
I have a question. When that happens, when you note it, when you note what's happening, what if it's very painful? An emotion, or maybe fear, or maybe something that really, you can stay with it, you can see how it changes, but it can be overwhelming.
So the question is, what happens if there's some pain or some emotion that's overwhelming? That's where discernment has to come into play. And so you have to have some sense of what the consequences are of hanging in there with it. And if you feel like you're drowning or getting more agitated or re-traumatizing that particular emotion, just making it, putting salt on the wound, perhaps it's not useful to continue that way. And so then you need to change, avoid, maybe not look at that anymore. Kind of turn the tension away, use loving kindness, or find something which is not so traumatizing or so. That's fine. The discernment is to, in a sense, we use our discernment to see what is helpful. For deepening our practice. And sometimes going into places of tremendous challenge is actually very helpful. And sometimes going into places of challenge are not helpful. So you have to have the wisdom to know. And sometimes you want to back off. And sometimes you want to just die, give up, just go into it. Hopefully you have the wisdom to see, to know. And if you're in doubt, then back off. Yes.
It's
seems like with experiences like discouragement, you mentioned, or sadness, whatever, that those are concepts rather than a bare experience, that there's a thought line, storyline connected with that, like discouragement, well, I'm not getting anywhere, I'm going to be a failure,
sadness,
right. You know, some abuse thing, whatever it might be, that gets away from what you're talking about in terms of the tension in the chest or the knee or whatever.
Well, the storyline around the discouragement is a story, but the emotion of discouragement, the heaviness, the sense of depression or sadness that might be there, that's more of a direct experience. So you can feel, you know, I can feel discouraged and then feel the heaviness and maybe the contraction or tightness I might feel someplace in my body. And just be with that and be with the emotional sense of it without then believing or getting caught or being swept away in the storyline about, you know, why I'm discouraged. Discouragement is, you know, I think a valid label for, you know, valid enough.
Therapeutically, we look at that as the secondary, that the thought is going on consciously or unconsciously before the emotion would be there to that degree.
Sure, I mean, that doesn't mean that, sure. I mean, one of the things that we start noticing when we do Vipassana practice is when the mind gives rise to some physical experience, and when some physical experience gives rise to something in the mind, it goes back and forth. And sometimes seemingly some kind of change in the body happens, emotional change, and then thoughts follow. And sometimes it's very obvious that thoughts are primary, and then some emotion follows. But even if thoughts are the catalyst for an emotion, the emotion is a kind of energetic felt sense thing in the body. It's real, real enough. I imagine, isn't it? Is that true?
Well, it may or may not. I mean, sometimes an emotion like discouragement may not necessarily be in the body. It could be, but ultimately, particularly if it was ignored, I could see how that it could come with tiredness or something like that.
Yeah. So the principle is to try to discern the difference between your interpretations, your concepts, your assigning a meaning, to the experience, the story making around something, and just stay with the simplicity of the actual experience itself. Let go of any concepts of time in relationship to it. Oh, this has to, you know, this has been here so long, or this better go away in 5 minutes, or that's applying concepts. Ideas of possession, this is mine. You know, this belongs to me, this is me, this defines me in some way. This, taking it personally. Ideas of good and bad. Just let the experience stand for itself. And then it helps the mind relax quite a bit if you just let your experience be as it is. Connect to it, sustain the attention there, and then notice, you know, how it changes, what it is, and as detailed as you can, really being there for it. And then, okay? I can talk so much more about all this, but you guys better, you know, try it. So that we can talk about something real, as opposed to me just telling more stories here. So thank you very much.